I take a peek inside the bag to make sure she brought it, that she brought my financial calculator, because I said the ones from the office sucked, citing their microscopic digits and keys that don't work as the cause, though Heidi never asked. But in reality, it was the only small thing I could remember that the elusive Willow Greer had touched inside my home. That first day in my office, when she leaned over to retrieve it from the floor, a shaky hand tracing each and every key, leaving behind an unmistakable identity neither she nor I could see. The only thing that would be within reason for Heidi to bring to me when we met for lunch. I could hardly suggest she bring the remote control, baby bottles, the old suitcase. And then I hurried to meet Martin Miller before I board the next plane.
Willow. On one of her prearranged visits, Ms. Adler arrived with a letter from the Zegers, as usual, though this one was completely different. She appeared on the front stoop, stomping the snow off her big fleecy boots before coming into the home. Joseph took her coat from her and laid it over the arm of a chair, and we all went into the kitchen where, as usual, we sat around the wooden table and a doped-up Miriam served us cookies and tea. This letter, though, wasn't about my Lily and how well she was doing in school, and how big she was growing up to be. No, this letter was completely different. This letter made the blood in my veins run cold, the air in the room too thin to breathe. I grasped that letter in my shaking hands and read aloud, as Joseph made me do so he wouldn't be left in the dark, about how 10 months before, Big Lily found herself suddenly, curiously pregnant, and how Rose, Lily, had become a big sister in December. The letter gushed with the minutiae of the baby's pale eyes and delicate hair, her gentle demeanor, the musical sound of her coo. This, Big Lily explained, was what she and Paul had always dreamed of, to have a baby of their own. Her name was Calla, as in the Calla Lily, half of a whole, and my Lily, no longer a lily but now a rose, was excluded, left out. Not the baby she and Paul had always dreamed of. But how? I whined. She wasn't... I thought... I set the letter on the table and swallowed hard against a bulge in my throat. I would not let Joseph see me cry, or Isaac, who stood back to the wall, a smirk on his ugly face. The caseworker was all smiles. How wonderful, she said, and what a wonderful surprise. Imagine Rose, a sister. As if Rose hadn't been a sister all along. My sister. Mine. Sometimes, she explained to me, her voice dumbed down like I was some idiot. This happens. I suppose they were never truly infertile, just... Her voice wavered off for a split second before she added, unlucky. Unlucky to have little Lily in their life rather than the baby they'd always dreamed of. There was no mention of my Lily in that letter, other than the simple blurb that she was a big sister. The rest of the note oozed with details of Calla's life, how she slept peacefully throughout the night, how for Lily giving birth to her own flesh and blood had been sublime. There was a photo attached, Big Lily and Calla, my Lily hovering in the background like an afterthought. Her hair was a mess, red sauce dribbled down the front of a plain white shirt. But Calla was pristine, in the softest-looking mauve one-piece, a denim headband with bow on her head. There was no letter from my Lily included. No third-grade school picture, no stationery with the red bird and tree, no distorted name printed across the front, Rose Zeger. My Lily had been replaced. It plagued me for days. I stayed awake night after night wondering what would happen to my Lily. Would the Zegers overlook her for the rest of her life, not good enough now that they had their own flesh and blood? Would they decide that two children were one too many? And would Lily be sent back to that group home to await a lousy foster home like the one I was living in? Would she stay in that group home forever, or until she turned 18 and was sent out into the world to fend for herself? To live like a waif on some Colorado or Nebraska street? I could only imagine. I conjured up visions of the Zegers ignoring her, forcing her to wear that stained white shirt for the rest of her life. The very name haunted me in the middle of the night. Calla. Calla. I hated it. I hated her. Calla had ruined my Lily's life. The days went on, I spent every waking hour reading and rereading that letter from Big Lily, staring at that photo of Big Lily and the baby. My Lily pushed so far into the background she almost fell out of the picture. This photo, unlike all the others, Joseph let me keep. In fact, he taped it up to that flowery wallpaper lest I forget that this baby, that Calla, was plundering my Lily's happy childhood. But what could I do?
Heidi. I spend the night in the rocking chair, hardly able to take my eyes off the sweet baby. When Zoe awakes and asks where Willow is, her cross eyes scanning the closed office door as she slides down the hall with a half-asleep gait, I say in a hushed tone, "Still sleeping." Though I know good and well that isn't true. I don't think about her at all. I don't think about Willow. Zoe departs for school, and the day comes and goes. I hardly take notice. Other than a quick lunch with Chris, the baby and I don't leave home. We spend much of the day in the rocking chair, my strides calculated, rhythmic, as Ruby sleeps on my lap, soundly, like a newborn babe. I can think of little but the shape of her eyes, can do little but count the milia on her nose. I watch as out the window the sun rises, and then moments later it begins to set, slipping beneath the massive skyscrapers that dot the city sky, staining the gauzy clouds a deep pink, a navy blue, a tea rose. Out the window, people awaken, commencing their work day. They return home a second later, the day through. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner come and go. My phone rings. There's the bleep of the intercom system. Someone or something beckoning me from the first floor. And yet I can't be bothered. Won't be bothered. Can't take my eyes off the baby as she sleeps and then awakens. Sleeps and then awakens, foraging in the folds of a fitted dress when she wants to eat. And it's then and only then that I rise from the rocking chair and prepare a bottle for her to consume. As afternoon gives way to evening, I watch Ruby sleep, while crepuscular rays fill the sky, straight lines that spill downward from the descending sun, shafts of light, the fingers of God. I don't mind the clock, completely oblivious to the aluminum hand that spins around the circular face, pointing at this Roman numeral and then that, this Roman number and then that. I hear neighbors in the hallway, coming home from work. I smell their dinners wafting under the door and through the walls, enchiladas and baked chicken, pork chops. My phone rings and then rings again, but I can't be bothered to rise from the chair and answer it, convincing myself that it's merely some telemarketer or an automated message from Zoe's superintendent about some upcoming meeting at the school which doesn't concern me, pertaining only to graduating seniors or to the parents of students with special needs. And then the front door bursts open, suddenly, violently, and there Zoe stands in her pink jersey and pink shorts, her feet cloaked in a pair of muddy cleats. Her shin guards are on, the hot pink socks that stretch all the way to her knees caked with mud. Her hair is woven into a double French braid, a unifying hairdo one of the team mothers has taken to giving the lucky charms each and every game, complete with some kind of homemade scrunchie that matches their uniforms. And she demands, "Where were you?" while tossing her backpack to the hardwood floor with a thud. She's glaring at me from the open doorway, and I watch as, behind her, a neighbor passes by with a pizza box in hand, trying hard to ignore the angry tone of Zoe's voice. The smell of it drifts into the room to greet me, and it's then that I realize I'm hungry. "You missed my game," she says, not giving me a chance to come up with some counterfeit response to the initial question. "I forgot," or "I got caught up at work and couldn't leave." Instead, all I can manage is, "I'm sorry," knowing the words sound fraudulent because, in fact, they are. I'm not sorry. Not sorry that I missed Zoe's game, because then I wouldn't have had this time with Ruby. Rocking here in this chair with Ruby in my arms. I tried calling you, she says. Her hands are placed on her hips, and there's a pout on her face. She looks to the kitchen and back again, aware that I've started nothing for dinner. Aware that in the near twilight, I'm all but sitting in the dark. She flips a light switch on over the kitchen table, and I find myself blinded by the light, waiting for my eyes to adjust. The baby lets out a moan, and I coo, "There now," wondering if it's the bright light or the surly tone of Zoe's voice that upsets her. "Why didn't you answer your phone?" Zoe barks out then. "I tried calling you. You missed the game. You missed the game completely," she cries. And for a second, I picture it. Zoe at her game with the rest of the Lucky Charms, refusing to acknowledge her mother's presence, as is the case each and every game. It's quite the quandary, it is. She doesn't want me there, and yet she doesn't want to be the only one without a mother in tow. But I don't answer this. I don't answer Zoe's question, "Why didn't you answer your phone?" Instead, I ask, "How did you get home?" "Do you hear me, Mom?" she asks, and I realize that I don't like that tone of her voice one bit. That sour tone of voice she's taken with me, as if she's in charge and I'm the pliant one. "Yes, Zoe, I heard you, but I asked you a question as well. How did you get home?" There's a huff, a retreat into the kitchen to ransack cabinets for something to eat, slamming this one and that. And then, "Coach paid for a cab. He couldn't stay there all night waiting, you know, like the other night. He has a life." A pause followed by, "You owe him $14. She yanks a bottle of water from the refrigerator door and states, "Ms. Markew says she's been trying to call you. She says you haven't returned her calls." Then, with a box of saltine crackers and the water, Zoe heads out of the room. She's gone about 5 feet when she pauses, stops dead in her tracks beside the closed office door, and asks, "Why haven't you returned your calls?" "I've been busy, Zoe. You know that," I respond, knowing that in Zoe's preteen mind, she can't make sense of it. How caring for an infant could classify as busy. Busy is doodling on a forearm and texting friends, eluding homework and salivating over the handsome Coach Sam. Busy is not the inexhaustible hours it takes to raise a child. "Well, are you going to call her back?" she asks. Her French braids hang long, their tail ends wrapping around the sides of her neck. She looks older to me than 12. When she isn't smiling and I can't see the braces that remind me she's still a child. I'm aware, for the first time in forever, of the sudden arrival of breasts. Were they there all along, and I simply failed to notice? Or has she turned into a young woman overnight? "Yes," I say, "of course." "When?" she interrogates. "Soon. I will call her soon." "That baby's not yours, you know," she says out of nowhere, noticing the tender way I cradle Ruby in my arms, the way I massage her head. "Why would you say such a thing?" I ask, my voice quiet, hurt. "It's like you think she's yours or something. It's weird." And then, "Where's Willow?" she asks dryly, as if her words didn't just blindside me. Didn't just punch me in the gut, and I say, sullenly, winded by the abuse, "She wasn't feeling well. She went to bed early," stating it in a hushed tone so that Zoe will believe. "The flu," I say, "it's going around." But Zoe, thinking perhaps about my fraudulent phone calls to Dana, receptionist extraordinaire, rolls her eyes and says cynically, "Yeah, right." And then she leaves, down the hall and into her bedroom, banging the door closed. And I return to Ruby, on my lap, rocking until blackness takes over the sky, until there is nothing left to see out that window but a smattering of stars in the electrified buildings, here, there, and everywhere.
Willow. I started seeing more and more of Matthew. Most often, we went to the library where we sneaked down one aisle or another to read books, sometimes, and to kiss. We went as early as we could, after Joseph and Isaac had left that Omaha home, because if we waited too long, there would be kids from schools filling the study tables at the ends of the aisles, loud and obnoxious, even up by the engineering books where no one else cared to go. But when we got there earlier in the day, around noon, the library was almost silent. Kids at school, adults working, and we could move about that aisle as if we were the only souls in the whole entire world. Even the librarians stayed away. Since no one ever checked out the engineering books, there were never any books to shelve. Only once did some librarian stop us and ask with a tone more curious than disapproving, "No school today?" And though I stopped dead in my tracks, my heart forgetting to beat, absolutely certain she was going to send me back to Joseph, it was Matthew who said, like he'd had this answer all ready to go for a long, long time, "We're homeschooled." And that librarian nodded her head and said, "How nice," and walked away. I didn't even know what that meant anyway. Homeschool. But Matthew did. And that was the end of it. No one ever asked what we were doing there again. Two kids out of school in the middle of the day. Matthew touched me in a way that was far different than Joseph ever did. Matthew's hands were considerate, whereas Joseph's were not. Matthew's hands moved slow and gentle, but Joseph's did not. I thought of Matthew's hands as an eraser of sorts, as if them touching me could erase that image of Joseph's hands right on out of my mind. Matthew talked more and more about getting me out of that home, but he said he knew his father wouldn't let me leave. And Matthew didn't have the money to take care of himself, much less me. Matthew never told me where he stayed once he left that homeless shelter. Not the truth, anyway. He talked about sleeping on a buddy's couch, or a friend letting him sleep on a cot in some storefront he owned. But when he said these things, he looked away, like when he talked about riding barges on the Missouri River. And I knew that he was lying. Matthew always looked tired. He started looking old. His skin was weathered, like maybe he was living on the street somewhere. I didn't know. But still, he talked about getting me out of that home. He talked about places outside of Omaha he wanted to see. The mountains. The beach. He talked about saving money. He talked about other ways he could get money. Stealing women's purses or robbing a bank. I didn't think Matthew had it in him, but if it got me out of that home with Joseph and Miriam then, I thought, okay, just so long as no one got hurt. "Maybe," he said. And one day. There were times when Matthew wanted to kiss me there in that Omaha home in my bedroom. There were times he wanted to lie beside me on the bed for reasons other than to read. I didn't know what Matthew did, and didn't know about Joseph, about what he did when he came into my room. I was too afraid to tell Matthew for fear he wouldn't believe me. "It's my word against yours," Joseph said. "No one will believe you." "And besides," Joseph reminded me, "I was a child that no one wanted. No one but him and Miriam." Matthew and my library trips continued throughout the fall and into winter. There were weeks, maybe more, when Joseph stayed home and didn't go to work. "Winter break," he said. And there he was in that house with me all day long, and I didn't see Matthew at all. But I thought about him. I thought about his hands on me, his lips on mine, the way he said my name. Claire. The snow fell from the sky, thick and heavy, coating the lawn with a layer of white. I stared out the window at that never-ending snow and thought of snowmen and sledding and snowball fights with Mama and Daddy, back in Ogallala, But here, the snow was just another reason to stay inside. The temperatures were cold, in and out of that Omaha home. The windows drafty. The heat set to no more than 68 degrees. It was cold all the time. Joseph went back to work, and Matthew returned. Winter continued on and on for nearly forever. And though the calendar had turned to March, the weather outside resembled anything but spring. Golden gray icicles clinging to the rooftops of the homes on our block. And then one early March day, Matthew came to fetch me to the library, excited to show me some new program he'd discovered on the computer. He was excited that day when he arrived, more animated than I'd seen him in a long, long time. The sky was the color of charcoal, the breath from our mouth that kind that flowed into the air like smoke. But what Matthew and I didn't know was that Joseph wasn't feeling well that day. We didn't know as we hopped on that blue bus and headed past the Woodman building that Joseph was lecturing over at the community college and starting to feel a headache coming on, and that as we pulled our chairs up to the computer, he was thinking about canceling his afternoon classes so he could go home and rest. There's no way we could have known as we put change into the vending machine for a bag of chips that he was packing up his stuff in his black backpack to go, or that, as we later settled down in the engineering aisle to peer through the books and to kiss, Joseph was in his car, driving home. The house was quiet when we came in, the cold wind all but pushing us through the front door. Matthew was talking about his mother, about Miriam, about how if he was ever a vegetable like her, he'd just want someone to shoot him, to take him out of his misery. I was stunned, staring at him with my mouth gaping wide, so that I didn't see Joseph parked on the edge of the corduroy recliner, gazing at us with his hawkish, hostile eyes. He was unmoving, still like a statue. Matthew froze in the doorway, and that's what made me freeze, too. Made me turn to see Joseph, with a lamp base in his hands, the flocked lampshade tossed to the ground beside his big, heavy boots. What happened next, I could hardly explain. Joseph's words were eerily calm as he asked us where we'd been. "A walk," Matthew said. And Joseph said nothing, twirling that lamp cord around and around in his hand, giving it a slight tug to check the tension. And then Joseph wanted to know where I'd gotten the clothes Matthew hung on to between visits so that Joseph wouldn't see. It had been a long time since Joseph and Matthew had laid eyes on one another. Joseph had no way of knowing that while he worked, Matthew was in and out of that very home. Joseph wanted me to say it. To tell him that we'd gone for a walk because lying lips, just like the thoughts of the wicked, were an abomination to God. He wanted me to say it aloud. He wanted the words to come from my mouth. And they did. And then he looked toward his son and said, "What did I always teach you, Matthew? Bad company ruins good morals. Isn't that what I always said?" And then it happened. Just like that. Joseph was moving across the room, striking Matthew with that lamp base again and again on the side of the head. There were words my mama only ever muttered under her breath hurled at the top of their lungs. I tried to stop Joseph, to get him to stop beating Matthew, but he knocked me down to the cold, hard floor. It took a minute to get my bearings, to get back up on my feet. But before I knew it, Joseph had me on the floor again, and this time there was blood oozing from my nose, thick and red and sticky. It happened so fast. The sound of the lamp base against solid bone. A streak of crimson blood soared through the air, splattering on the oatmeal-colored wall. Epithets muttered between gasping breaths, "son of a bitch," and "bastard," and "prick." Random objects used as weapons, the telephone, a vase, the TV's remote control, breaking glass. A cry, more blood. Me on the floor in the tornado position, feeling the ground shake as though an earthquake was passing through. And then Isaac was there, too, home from school or work, I assumed, and Isaac and Joseph were beating Matthew so badly I don't know how he managed to stay on his own 2 feet. I was crying out loud, "Stop! And leave him alone!" But no one was listening to me. Matthew groped for a candlestick and managed to connect with the side of Isaac's head, immobilizing him for a split second. Isaac lost his balance and staggered, thrust a hand to his own head, and when Matthew raised that candlestick, Joseph managed to knock it right on out of his hand. I don't know how long it went on, 30 seconds, 30 minutes. It seemed like forever. That I knew for sure. And there was nothing I could do.
So this was in self-defense, then?
Asks Louise Flores. Is that what you're implying? She thrusts up the sleeves of the scratchy cardigan and fans a spare sheet of paper against her head. She's sweating. The day outside must be warm, spring morphing into summer. Beads of perspiration form on the bridge of her nose and the wrinkles of her raisin-like skin. I see the sun through the lone window pouring across the dismal room and filling the darkness with light. Yes, Ms. Flores, I say. Of course. I still see Matthew when I close my eyes, the sight of him with blood streaked throughout his dark brown hair, running crossways down his face. He looked like he was 10 years old that day, there in the living room, with Joseph and Isaac ganging up on him. I hated that I couldn't do anything to stop it, but even worse, I hated what I knew Matthew was feeling, powerless and weak. His eyes gazed past mine, and I knew that more than anything, he felt ashamed. After some time, I admit to Ms. Flores, Matthew left. He didn't want to, you know. He didn't want to leave me there in that home with them. But there was nothing he could do. I tell her how Matthew managed to drag himself out the front door and leave that ugly March afternoon. I see it still, Matthew all but crawling out the front door. I hear Joseph and Isaac laughing. I hear them heckle Matthew as he crawled away.
To where? She asks. Where did Matthew go?
I don't know, I say. I don't know. I picture it, his sorry eyes settling on mine before he turned and moved out that door. Joseph and Isaac laughing mockingly, taunting Matthew out the door. They figured they'd won. But I knew this was far from through.
And then what happened, once Matthew had left?
I pull back my hair and show her the crater Joseph left behind when he pummeled me with that lamp. He waited until Matthew was out of sight, Isaac still snickering, still calling Matthew a pussy out the front window, and he turned to me with the meanest eyes I'd ever seen in my whole entire life. He picked the lamp base up from the floor, dented at both ends, and smacked me point blank on the side of my head. I don't remember it hurting so much, but I do remember its crippling effects, the way my body lost all feeling, lost its ability to stand on my own 2 feet. The way I crumpled to the floor and Isaac stood, watching and pointing, laughing. I remember the blackness that crept in from the edges of my eyes until I could no longer see, the ugly words and voices in the background that ebbed until all was silent. When I awoke, I was in that bedroom of mine, on the bed, on top of the patchwork quilt, the door locked from the outside.
Chris. I'm in my Denver hotel room, washing up for bed, dead tired. I've got the smallest room in the hotel, but even that goes for over $200 a night. The view outside the window could be any other city, any other night. To me, it all looks the same anymore. Big buildings, thousands of lights. I've got on some pajama pants, blue seersucker, a little snug, an undershirt. On the bed sits my open laptop. The day's newspaper, the Denver Post, which I picked up on the way out of the airport, lies ignored. The furthest I got was the front page blurb on the weather, cold, and the day's lottery numbers. I didn't win. I'm tired, the exhaustion marking my face. I stare at myself in the mirror and think that I am looking older, that I am getting older, that I can't keep up this pace much longer. I'm ruminating on other jobs. College professor, maybe management consulting, as I brush my teeth. I'm imagining myself at the front of a crowded auditorium, standing before the podium, lecturing on global capitalism before a bunch of cocky kids who used to be me, back when I was consumed with money. Money, money, money. I'd take a huge pay cut teaching, that's for sure. But Heidi and I would make do, I think, spitting toothpaste into the bathroom sink. We'd put the condo on the market. Maybe rent for a while. Maybe Zoe could go to a public school, even though I know that won't fly. But maybe. Hell, maybe we'd move to suburbia, buy a single-family home with a fenced-in yard, get a dog. We'd take the train into work. Live the real American dream. It could work. I'm thinking what it would be like to be home for dinner. What it would be like to lie in bed beside my wife every night. I'm picturing Heidi that afternoon at that Asian grill. The way she leaned in close to me, pressed her lips to mine. The way she laid her hand on mine. The way she uttered those words, "You must be so tired, Chris." Concerned for once about me, her husband, and not just foreign refugees from around the world. Mindful of my needs, and not just those of homeless girls and stray cats. Maybe something was changing. I pine for the olden days. Heidi at that benefit dinner in her vintage red dress, dancing with me after everyone else had left the building, after the dimmed lights had been flipped back on, and the catering staff was cleaning up the room. She was a college student at the time, and so she had nothing more than a dorm room to her name. I was right out of school, paying more in student loans than the national debt. I was dirt poor, living in a studio apartment in Roscoe Village, which we took a cab to, running wildly up the steps of the walk-up apartment, me forward and Heidi gracefully, in reverse, undressing each other along the way. We never made it to the bed, but fell to the floor right behind the door. By morning, I expected that she'd be gone, because certainly someone that amazing, with her beautiful brown eyes, wouldn't want a thing to do with me in the light of day. But I was wrong. We stayed in bed half the day, watching the pedestrians who moved up and down Belmont through the windows. That and The Price is Right. Then later, when we finally did get up and get dressed, Heidi sporting my Bears sweatshirt thrown over her own red dress, we went shopping for antiques, buying an old beer tap handle because it was the only thing we could afford. Heidi stayed with me for 3 days, living in my undershirts and boxer shorts, surviving on takeout and delivery. I went to work in the morning, and when I came home, she was there. She was easygoing in a way I thought she'd always be, but that was long before Zoe and cancer and the heavy weight of reality. I think about that weight, how it must deplete her. I think of Heidi, caring more about the rest of the world and everyone else's insatiable needs than she does her own. I stand in the bathroom in that Denver hotel, thinking to myself, I miss Heidi, when there's a knock on the door. A light rat-a-tat-tat, and I know who it is before I ever glance through the peephole. I open the door, and there she is. Not Heidi, of course, though there's a split second of what if. What if it is Heidi, flown all the way to Denver to see me, abandoning that girl and her baby who have consumed our home, swallowing my wife whole? What if she made arrangements for Zoe to stay with Jennifer, hopped a flight out to Denver, and now here she is, to spend the night with me. But the scene that greets me instead is something else entirely. Cassidy Knudsen letting herself into my room. She's wearing leggings, black and tight, with some sort of baggy tunic whose V-neck exposes the basin between her breasts, a valley, a ravine set between neighboring hills, the skin soft and pale, up for grabs. She wears some sort of pendant necklace, with a long copper chain that forces the eyes to the V of that tunic, forces the eyes down to where the charm sits tucked beneath the shirt at the end of the copper chain. The makeup on her face is barely there, save for the bright red lipstick that seems to have become a matter of course, the norm. There are heels on her feet, 4-inch heels, red, like the lipstick. She lets herself in, as always, without waiting to be invited. And there I stand, in my pajama pants and undershirt, still clutching a toothbrush in my hand. I didn't know you were stopping by, I say, or I would have... My voice drifts off, and I'm not sure what to say. I glance around the room to see the day's clothing in a pile on the floor, the seersucker pants that cling to my legs like plastic wrap. She doesn't have to tell me why she's there. I know what she's come to do. She moves quickly, her hands on me, her lips on mine, stating in an undertone, I can't tell you how long I've wanted to do this. And I say, Cassidy, though I'm not sure if the word comes out argumentative or inviting. I make a feeble attempt to slide away, out of reach, though deep inside my mind screams at me to let her, to push those forgotten memories of another Heidi out of my mind, and let Cassidy do as she pleases, whatever she came here to do. And then she's touching me, but her hands are cold, different from Heidi's in so many ways. They are bold and presumptuous, not waiting to get acquainted before they dive right in, full steam ahead. She's doing everything wrong, not the way Heidi would do it. Heidi, who is indulgent in the way she touches me, tender. And I find myself thinking about Heidi suddenly, desperately, longing for Heidi, wishing it were Heidi here in this hotel room with me. I'm thinking what Heidi would say if she knew what was happening right now. How it would make her feel. Heidi, who is wholesome, generous beyond belief. Heidi, who refuses to smash a spider with a shoe. "Stop," I say, pushing her away, gently at first, and then harder. "Stop, Cassidy," I say. "I can't do this. I can't do this to Heidi." I want Heidi. I miss Heidi. I miss my wife. But Cassidy is staring at me with this morose look on her face, and she says, "You've got to be kidding, Chris." And it's not that she's had her feelings hurt, or that she's feeling embarrassed that she's been refused. "Heidi?" she asks. She stares at me with puppy dog eyes, big and blue, pouting, saying my wife's name as if it is low grade. It isn't that Cassidy can't believe she's been turned down. It's that she can't believe she's been turned down for Heidi. I miss Heidi and her goodness, her virtue. I miss that she cares for homeless cats and illiterate men and children in countries whose names I can't say. Azerbaijan and Kyrgyzstan and Bahrain. I can't stand to stay there in that room with Cassidy. My pulse beats loudly in my ear. My hands are clammy, my balance off, as I thrust my feet into a pair of loafers waiting by the door. Cassidy's voice in the background, calling me by name, laughing, saying, "Don't go," leaving me dizzy. Vertigo. I lay a hand on the wall to steady myself as Cassidy continues to incant my name, to reveal herself to me as if it might just change my mind.
Willow. What I tell Ms. Flores is that Joseph brought me meals twice a day, and twice a day he removed them from my room. I tell her that he wouldn't let me out, even to pee. From time to time he'd come to empty a jar he had given me, though the smell of my own pee never went with it, and that every night he came to call, unlocking and thrusting open that bedroom door and telling me to undress. I tell her that every night after he'd gone to bed, I checked that door to make sure it was locked. I tell her that I sat there day in and day out, praying that one day he might forget to lock the door. I tell her that Matthew never came around, that I didn't see him again after that day he limped out the front door. I tell her that I didn't see Isaac, though I heard his voice echoing throughout the home, and knew that he was there, moving in and out of a world I could no longer see. I tell her that I watched out the bedroom window as the snow melted away, leaving gaping puddles along the sidewalks and in the potholed street. I tell her that once a day I was allowed to leave the room, only to defecate. I tell her how Joseph stood in the doorway and watched me go. I tell her how once I didn't make it to the toilet in time, and how Joseph made me sit in it for days, until my rear end was covered in a rash meant only for babies. I tell her how he laughed, how I heard Joseph and Isaac talking later about how I shit my pants. I tell her how one night, by the grace of God, after Joseph paid me a visit, he slipped out of the bedroom door and forgot to lock it as he left. I sat on the bed, waiting for the awful sound of the metallic key jingling in the lock. But there was none. Just the whine of floorboards as he moved through the home, the heavy sound of him climbing into his bed, the fuss of the mattress springs when he laid his immense body upon it. I waited for an hour at least, just to make sure, before I stood from the bed and wandered across the cold room, before I inched a shaking hand onto that bronze lever and opened the door. I tell Ms. Flores how I found the knife in a kitchen drawer. The biggest one from a 12-piece cutlery set, a chef's knife, at least 8 inches long or more. I tell her how I stood there in that darkened kitchen, watching the faint glow of the moon in the distance and thinking, though there was no need to think because I'd already decided. The house was quiet, but for the hiss of the furnace and the movement of water through pipes. But of course I don't know one way or another because that night, before Matthew arrived, I didn't step 1 foot out of my room. I tell her how I tiptoed into the bedroom and how I watched Joseph sleep, how I watched his fiendish body upon the big bed, how I heard him snore. Ms. Flores is scribbling maniacally across her paper now, making sure she gets the details just right. The way Joseph's eyes flew open as I approached the bed, the squeaky floorboards awakening him from sleep. How he sat upright in bed, the look in his eyes not scared but confused. How he mumbled, "How did you?" before I jammed that chef's knife into his chest. "How did you get out of your room?" was what he was going to say. But I didn't give him a chance. That's what I tell her. His eyes, his mouth gaped open and his hands felt blindly for the knife before I tore it out and thrust it in again. And again. 6 times, they said. That's what they told me when they found me. But of course, how would I know, because that night, I didn't step foot in Joseph and Miriam's room. What I knew, but what I didn't tell Ms. Flores, was that someone older than 18 would be tried as an adult, but not someone who was 16, someone like me who'd never been in trouble with the law. I wouldn't get in as much trouble as Matthew would if they knew the truth. I knew that 'cause Daddy had told me, back when I was just a kid and we were watching some story on the news, some story about a 16-year-old who murdered her folks. Daddy said kids sometimes got away with it, while adults went to jail, plain and simple. If they didn't get executed, I remember that I'd ask Daddy, "What's executed?" But he never did say, though I figured it out nonetheless. "And Miriam?" asks Ms. Flores. "What about Miriam? Tell me what happened to Miriam." "She didn't wake up," I say. Not that I know one way or the other since I wasn't there, in that room. I claim that she lay there sound asleep while I thrust that chef's knife in and out of Joseph's chest. But Ms. Flores is bound and determined. She sets her pen on the table and double-checks the tape recorder to make sure it's still working. She's got to get this on tape, my confession. "Then why did you kill her too?" she asks, and my spit catches in my throat and I choke. "Miriam?" I almost ask aloud. But then I hear Matthew's voice in my mind, and slowly, even slower than molasses in January, it sinks in. "If I was ever a vegetable like my mom, I'd want someone to just shoot me, to take me out of my misery." And that's just what he did.
Heidi. In the early afternoon when Ruby is asleep, I walk through the condo collecting items of clothing thrown at random here and there. Ruby's jumpsuit stuffed helter-skelter in the cushions of the sofa. Discarded socks of Zoe's left beside the front door. I drop them into a heaping laundry basket, make my way into Chris's and my bedroom, and retrieve an overused bra slung over the door handle. I lift his suitcase from the floor, the one we exchanged at the Asian Grill on Michigan Avenue, and begin to sort through its contents. Button-down oxfords, work pants stuffed into a ball in the corner of the bag. I lift the pants from the bag, checking the pockets for pens and pen caps, handfuls of coins, the type of random things that typically materialize from Chris's pockets while in the wash, bottle caps and binder clips, an entire package of travel tissues that disintegrate into a million pieces, and my hand lands on something I recognized almost instantly, even before pulling the shiny blue package from the pocket. The words, "her pleasure," socking me in the gut. I double over before the bed, dropping the laundry basket to the floor. Some kind of gravelly sound emerges from me, a gritty, desperate grasp for air. I press a hand, 2 hands, to my mouth to silence the squall that wells up inside me, a sudden, violent storm brewing deep inside my bowels. I stare at that condom wrapper, confirming everything I believed to be true. My husband is having an affair with Cassidy Knudsen. I envision the two of them in ostentatious hotels in San Francisco, New York City, and now Denver, their bodies coalescing between Egyptian cotton sheets. I see them in Chris's uninhabited office during non-business hours, and me stupidly falling for another cover story, working on an offering memorandum or writing a prospectus, doing due diligence on one company or another. These burdens, the long hours, the endless business trips, were his alibi, his attempt to camouflage a secret liaison with another woman. My head spins, imagining Chris in the kitchen, humbly admitting that Cassidy Knudsen would be joining him on his last trip. I picture the two of them together, later on in their hotel room, laughing about it. Laughing about how piqued I'd been to discover that she'd been there. I picture the two of them taking pleasure in my unease and insecurity, in my jealousy. "It's a business trip," Chris had said, "strictly business." And yet, I put it all together in my head. The unanswered phone call, the contraceptive in the pocket of Chris's work pants. The proof, finally, that I've longed for so long. I cross the bedroom to the dresser and remove from the top drawer various items that I lay across the bed. A set of matching underwear, lace bra, and panties in a pale shade of pink. I stare at those items long and hard, knowing what needs to be done to settle the score.
Willow. Of course, everything I told Louise Flores was not the truth. She had me write it all down in my own words, on a fresh sheet of notebook paper. She paced the room, her heels clicking on the concrete floors, while I wrote it all down, about the chef's knife, and Joseph with his gaping eyes. I even made up a thing or two about Miriam, how she was asleep when I went into the room, but I did her in nonetheless, just because I could. She gazes at me, shaking her head, and says, "You're just lucky you're a juvenile, Claire. Do you have any idea what would happen to you if you were tried as an adult?" I shrug my shoulders and say, "There's no death penalty in Illinois." She stops her pacing all of a sudden and peers over a shoulder at me. "But you didn't commit the crime in Illinois, Claire," she says. "You were in Nebraska, where I know good and well murderers can be put to death by lethal injection. Especially those over 18, those who commit murders that are willful and premeditated. Like someone waiting until someone is asleep before creeping into their room with a knife. I didn't want Matthew to get in any trouble, because I knew that what he did for me. Never did I stop thinking of Matthew, not one day since I left. I thought about him every single day and at night when I lay down on the bed. I thought of him and cried. Quiet-like, so Mrs. Wood and Mr. Wood wouldn't hear. I wondered where he was, wondered if he was okay. When she's got it all, the whole grand confession in writing and on tape, she tells the guard to bring me back to my room, where Diva sits on the floor and sings, tapping her long vermilion fingernails against the bars of our cage for a percussion effect, though someone screams at her to shut up. I ignore her interrogation. "Where have you been all day?" and climb onto my bunk, pulling a thin white sheet over me, all the way up over my head. I close my eyes and remember that night. The things I didn't tell Ms. Flores.
Heidi. Beside me on the bed lay a set of matching underwear, lace bra and panties in a pale shade of pink. I slip into them and drift to the open closet doors, reaching deep inside. In the back, I find what I'm looking for. Hung from a department store hanger, still covered in plastic sheeting, a knot tied at its base. Never worn. I loosen the knot and gently lift the plastic from the dress. Dropping it to the floor, I remember the day I made the purchase, some 7 months ago. The day I called Chris's favorite steakhouse in the old refurbished brownstone on Ontario Street and made reservations for a quieter table away from the bar, the very one where Chris proposed to me. I'd planned for Zoe to stay with Jennifer and Taylor, had left work early to get my hair done, a side-swept chignon to partner with the new dress, a pair of black pumps with a kitten heel. I released the dress from its hanger, remembering how Chris had called before I ever had a chance to wear it, griping about some last-minute task. And in the background, there was her voice, Cassidy's, beckoning my husband, stealing him away from our anniversary date. "I'll make it up to you," he'd promised. His disappointment diluted over the phone as if maybe, just maybe, he didn't care at all. "Soon." I run my fingers over the dress. A crepe shift dress with buttons up the back, black. I drape it over my head, letting it slide down over the pink bra and panties, and then stare at my reflection in the full-length mirror. I remember that October night, the night of our anniversary. I remember that it was Graham who had come over instead, beckoned by the sound of the TV on a night he knew I shouldn't be home. He stood in the doorway, sympathy carpeting his face, knowing without my needing to tell him what had happened. Me in a robe and slippers in place of the little black dress, my hair dazzling in its side-swept chignon, The Price is Right on the TV, a frozen TV dinner baking in the oven. "He doesn't deserve you," was all he said. And then, in a throwback to long-lost college days, we played a round of Century Club with Chris's adored pale ales, until we were drunk and bloated, and my memories of being stood up by my work-obsessed husband had become hazy and opaque. I passed out on the sofa, waking the next morning to empty bottles of beer, over a dozen of them strewn upon the coffee table and floor, a vase of flowers set at their center, Chris's weak attempt at a pardon. He was out the door before I awoke. I trace my eyes in a dark liner, sweeping a smoky shadow across the lids. I smear Bordeaux lipstick onto my lips and smack them together, wiping away the excess with a tissue. I tie my hair into a messy knot on the top of my head, sad in comparison to that beautiful $60 chignon, I think, reaching into the depths of the closet for the box containing the black pumps with their kitten heels. I roll a pair of nylons up my legs and slip into the heels, standing before the mirror. I pass by the baby, sound asleep on the pink fleece blanket on the floor. I watch her for a short time, refusing to stay too long and divert my course. I watch to make sure she is asleep, that she will not notice my absence, and then I walk into the hallway and gently close the door. I don't take the time to catch my breath. I refuse to slow down and think. Graham opens the door before my knuckles rap for a second time. There he stands, impeccable and smiling, in a pair of jeans and an undershirt. He takes in the dress and hair, the overblown makeup, eyeing me from top to bottom. "Ooh la la," he says, as I reach back and begin to unfasten the buttons from my dress. His laptop sits on the tufted sofa cushions, abandoned. Nina Simone warbles throughout the room. "What are you?" Graham starts, leading me inside and closing the door. I lift that dress up over my head, exposing the pale pink beneath. His eyes fall to the pink, to the lace, getting lost long enough to affirm that Chris's perception of Graham is far from true. "You don't want to do this," he says to me, but I say that I do. I step toward him, taking in the paragon, the ideal that is Graham, letting his warm hands wander across my midriff, wrapping around to the small of my back. And Graham, being the good friend that he is happy to oblige. He's more than happy to do me this favor. An act of goodwill. A common courtesy, I think, as he leads me past the tufted sofa and onto an unmade bed.
Willow. It was late. The house was silent. Joseph had come and gone. I was awoken by a scream, a thick, throaty scream that forced me straight up in bed. I remember the moon through the window, incandescent on an otherwise black night. I remember that there was silence following that scream. So much silence that I wondered whether or not it had only been a dream. I lay in bed, staring at that moon, willing my heart to slow down, my breath to return to me from wherever it went when I heard that scream. The clouds floated by the moon slowly, lazily, the knobby arms of the big old trees now shadows in the night. They stirred in the air, their branches reaching out to touch one another, to clasp hands. And then I heard it, the clink of a metallic key in the lock, the frantic turning of the door's handle. What I expected to see was Joseph, his silhouette against the faint glow of some light from down the hall. But instead, it was Matthew who tore into my room with a deranged look in his eye, his convulsive hand bearing a sharp knife that dripped blood across my bed as he said, "Come on, Claire, get up." And I reached for his outstretched hand and let him pull me from bed. "You need to go, Claire," he said to me, sweeping me close, tight in a bear hug. "You need to run." He tossed clothes into my hands, the sweatshirt and gym shoes, a pair of enormous pants, and told me to get dressed. "Hurry," he said, his voice rattling. "Why?" I asked, and then, "Where?" "There's a bag," he said. "By the front door. A suitcase. It has everything you'll need." And he pulled on my hand and led me down the hall, through a house that was nearly silent. The door to Joseph and Miriam's bedroom pulled closed. I cringed as I passed that bedroom door, fearful of what was or wasn't on the other side. I couldn't decide what was worse, what was there or what I imagined to be there, though there was no way to know for sure. "But what about Joseph?" I asked, though I knew, between the blood and the closed door, by the fact that Matthew and I were moving freely down the wooden steps, making no effort to mute the sounds of the squeaky floors, that Joseph was dead, that the scream had belonged to Joseph, that the blood on the knife was his. He clutched me by the hand on the bottom step and forced me into him. He whispered into my ear, "I know what he did to you." And I felt my legs give, knowing he knew my secret, knowing he knew Joseph's secret. Somehow it was a weight off, the fact that I no longer had to carry that baggage alone. I imagined all those years Joseph welcoming himself onto the bed beside me, and Matthew on the other side of the wall, listening. I clung to Matthew there at the bottom of the steps, not wanting to go, though he said again, "You have to go, Claire. You have to go now," and unclasped my hands from the small of his back. "Where?" I asked, my voice anxious and scared. I'd never been on my own before in my whole entire life. "There's a cab," he said, "outside, waiting. He'll take you to the bus station." And it was only then that I noticed the headlights of a car parked at the curb. "But I don't want to go," I cried, my eyes darting to Matthew, ambiguous in the blackness of the night. "I want to stay with you." And I clung to him like Velcro, wrapping my arms around his back, and for a second he let me, just a split second, before he unclamped my fingers and pried me away. I was crying, this heaving cry that came from somewhere deep within. "Come with me," I begged, weeping so hard that I had to force the words out between breaths. "Come with me." Matthew was the only person I had in the whole wide world. Mama had left me. Lily had left me. And now Matthew was leaving me too. "Claire, come with me," I pleaded like the child I was. I stamped my foot and threw my arms across myself with a pout on my face. "Come with me, come with me." And I tried pulling on his arm and dragging him to the door, toward that front door that stood open, the window to the side of the door smashed in, shards of jagged glass strewn upon the floor. I froze solid for a second and stared. This is how Matthew had found his way in.
"You have to go, Claire."
Matthew jammed money into my hand,
a stack of cash, and hurried to grab the leather suitcase from the floor, towing me behind him by the hand. "Go now,"